Welcome to the Full of Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 9:07 British Summer Time. Today is September 27th, and today being Friday, it's the big picture long-term audio for the various different asset classes. Now, if we have a review of what's been happening this week, then we've seen that gold had had the upside key reversal in the latter half of last week, and then prices deteriorated for the first few days of the week and came right back to test the $1,300 area, and we're a bit firmer in here today and up to up about $12 and closing out the week in the region of $1,336. And considering that we had that big upper dynamic last week and that we're now seeing a little bit of steadying in here, it would suggest that we're in the process of building a higher reaction low in gold, and that would support the argument that we're going to see some higher to lateral ranging over the next few months. In stock markets, well, Wall Street hit a new all-time high about 10 days ago in the region of 1729 and has been pulling back on pretty much consecutive days since then and is down to about 1691. So a 40-point pullback in the context of a 1690-point index isn't really very much. So that really helps to emphasize the fact that we haven't had anything in the way of really big downward dynamics to suggest that supply is really coming back into dominance here. And what this pullback really looks like is more of an unwinding of the short-term overbought condition. And when we look at the S&P over the last year, a progression of higher reaction lows is evident. And while there's been a bit of loss of momentum over the last few months, really a break in that progression of higher reaction lows would be required to begin to question the consistency of the overall uptrend. In Europe, the majority of indices had rallied so very impressively over the first half of September and are now pausing at least in the upper side of their ranges. And the Italian index was a bit weaker yesterday and off its lows, and it gave up another 1.25% in here today. And the Spanish market, which had pushed up so very impressively, was down by about 0.5%. So we're definitely seeing some consolidation of recent gains for the majority of the European indices. And in Asia, the Chinese market pulled back sharply in the first half of the week, but has been reasonably steady for the latter half of the week. And China has some of the lowest valuations in the world, particularly of any major market. And really what does look appear, or what appears to be underway, is some base building and potentially the return to demand dominance. And provided the Chinese market continues to hold above the lows from earlier this year, then we can give the benefit of the doubt to recovery. The Hong Kong market continues to range and has been range-bound now for quite some time. By and large, when we look at the Asian markets, then the relative strength of the dollar in the first half of this month took a toll on the performance of the stock markets in the vast majority of emerging Asia. And what we've subsequently seen is that the weakness of the US dollar has translated into some relative strength for Asian currencies, and we've seen a pretty impressive rebounds for the majority of stock markets. We're now getting to a phase where a good deal of the oversold condition has been unwound by a number of those markets, and questions are now being asked as to what happens next. And because we've had this linkage created between foreign currency investors in Asian markets and their sensitivity to the variations in their currencies, not least because a number of these investors are on a leveraged basis and their carry trade will really have will be quite seriously affected by currency weakness in the destination assets. So the outlook for the US dollar has been questioned now, where the dollar is a bit weaker again in here today. The pound was stronger today by a full cent against the dollar. It's up to 161. The euro was stronger by another 31 cents and is up to 135. When we look at the Chinese market, and purchasing managers' indices are improving, and the slowdown that has been evident across a number of markets appears to be troughing, And with Europe returning to a growth trajectory, and Mr. Carney at the Bank of England today saying that they don't see any need to add additional liquidity into the market or additional stimulus because they think that the UK economy is back onto a growth footing. Well, that's all pretty positive for their respective currencies. And against that background, is there such a need for a strong US dollar, not least as we head into another bout of acrimonious debating about the raising of the debt ceiling? So the US dollar has been a bit weaker in here today and for much of the week. That is a tailwind for Asian markets from the perspective of foreign investors who are looking at some of those markets. When we think about the equity markets, we need to increasingly consider what's happening in the bond markets. And in terms of the prices, or we've had this deterioration in bond prices, and the oversold condition that had developed is being unwound, and the catalyst for that unwind was the Fed delaying their tapering last week. And there is still potential for an additional unwind of that short-term oversold condition in terms of the bond prices. And that suggests that we're going to see some additional weakness in the yields. And what has happened in terms of government bonds is that the momentum that has helped to drive yields to extraordinary lows over the last number of years is now being questioned. The Fed, which had been adding $85 billion a month into both the mortgage markets and the treasury markets, is coming towards the end of that process. We don't exactly know when that is going to begin to be tapered, but we do know that they're considering it and they're waiting for supporting evidence to begin doing it, and that the likelihood of the $85 billion number being exceeded is becoming an increasingly unlikely prospect. And the very mention of the potential removing of that stimulus was enough to begin to get people to start to reassess their positions in government bonds and in associated asset classes. And when we look at the total return index for US Treasury futures, then that really is very important and perhaps the most important chart in the world. And that's been the case now for really quite some time. When, and something that we cover really in quite a lot of detail in the chart seminar, but when a chart has been so remarkably consistent and then starts to become inconsistent, well, we can draw very simple conclusions from that, and that is that the animating forces that were helping to drive the consistency of the trend have changed. And if the major forces that were helping to drive the uptrend have changed, then we need to reassess. And that is what has happened in government bonds. That total return index for US Treasury futures was the most consistent trend in the world over 30 years until earlier this year. It failed to sustain a break upwards to new high ground. It pulled back into the lower, into the underlying trading range. It broke down from that trading range. It's extended the largest decline below its 200-day moving average in its history. So these are major trend inconsistencies. And when you're presented with an incredibly consistent advance, then the most productive trading strategy is to buy the dips, and then to do so on a leverage basis. And now that we have had these inconsistencies, that strategy is unlikely to continue to work. And what we can anticipate, and we're already seeing, is that people are saying, well, bonds have fallen enough. We've seen bond funds come back very aggressively. They're beginning to find support. Every other time they have pulled back like this, it's being a buying opportunity. We should get in there and we should start buying once more. And We've already seen that some of these government bond yields are starting to contract and some of the government bond futures are starting to rally. So we're being presented now with evidence that some support has been found and that the short-term oversold conditions for a number of these bond funds, whether they are straight bonds or corporate bonds, mortgage bonds, municipal bonds, all of these ETFs, all of these funds are now beginning to unwind their oversold conditions. And they'd pulled back so very sharply. And that people had been caught by surprise. And people were praying for them to start to go back up. And now we're starting to see people starting to talk about the possibility that these bond funds are now representing value. But if the total return index has topped out, and we're now seeing an unwind of the short-term overbought condition, then we would expect that that rally will encounter resistance in the region of the 200-day moving average. And that on the next decline, the lows will be exceeded. In other words, we'll be into a downtrending situation. And that suggests that while in the short term, we have the prospect of an additional rally for government bond prices, corporate bond prices, mortgage bond prices, and municipal prices, that this rally is likely to present an opportunity to lighten into a rally. And once we have these oversold conditions relative to their 200-day moving averages have been unwound, then the possibility of, or the potential for, some type 2 right-hand extension before the medium-term downtrend is reasserted, I think is very high indeed. We've had the massive reaction against the prevailing trend. People look around, they ask, what's changed? Probably not a great deal in terms of the market. And now we're starting to see the unwind of that oversold condition. And there's going to be a great deal of disagreement in the market and probably quite a heightened degree of volatility. But if the total return index has topped out, then that would suggest that the entire outlook for the government bond sector and for bonds generally has changed. And then we start to think about, where do returns come from when you buy bonds? Well, you have, in very general terms, you have the potential for capital appreciation and your yield. And you have your yield, and how is that calculated? More often than not, it's on a yield to maturity basis. Well, if we're in a downtrending environment for government bonds, government bond prices, that would suggest that the potential for capital appreciation is going to deteriorate. And that means that more responsibility is going to have to move on to the yield component of the total return. And that's when an understanding of what exactly yield to maturity means is going to become probably the most relevant consideration for a lot of people. Because if you own straight bonds, then you're going to be able to hold your bond and get your principal back at maturity. So the entry point for your investment is going to have a material effect on your total return for that investment. But if you buy a bond fund, well, bond funds don't have a yield to maturity. They're a straight play on capital appreciation. And that means that they are much more leveraged to a deterioration in bond prices than they are to rising yields. And that is part of the reason that they pulled back so very abruptly. That is also part of the reason that they are now starting to rally that bit more impressively. But they represent a clear risk now to not least pension fund investors. And I was in Boston around this time last year, and I remember seeing this sign over the river from Prudential saying that we manage $1 trillion. And I remember at the time thinking, what do they hold? And my only conclusion was that they must have held a lot of bonds. And when we think about the relative size of various markets, well, the bond markets are a multiple, if not multiples, the size of the equity markets. And when people start to think about the size of bond funds, then it's not unusual to talk about billions and hundreds of billions of dollars and euros and pounds and yen. So what happens in the government bond markets is going to have an impact in just about everything else. And when we think about the amount of bonds that have been produced and the momentum that has been in that market and what the eventual removal of the momentum is likely to be, then it's going to result in higher yields. And investors are going to be forced to demand higher yields because of the removal of the surety of capital appreciation. Now, the Fed isn't going to move ahead and taper without having some form of evidence that the economy is beginning to improve. And they're not going to remove the quantitative easing until they have self-sustaining growth and a tick upwards in the velocity of money. With the improving situation in the global economy, then that should generally be positive for the equity markets. And it is that underlying strength is that is likely to carry equity markets through this, what is likely to be a rather difficult scenario, which is likely to result in quite a bit of ranging for the majority of markets. Now, if we think about exactly what has driven the equity markets over the last 4 years, well, at Fuller Money, we've described it on a number of occasions as a liquidity-fueled rally. And part of the reason for that is because central banks, and not just the Fed, but just about all major central banks, have been engaged in money printing. And a lot of that additional money has found its way into risk assets, and not least in stock markets. And when we had a situation in stock markets when the equity markets yielded more than the government bond markets, then the argument for participating in the equity markets just on a yield basis was really quite compelling. When we think about where that liquidity has been deployed in the equity markets, then not only governments have been binging on debt, but corporations have used the lowest yields anyone has ever seen to optimize their balance sheets. So they've been retiring older, more expensive debt and taking out new, cheaper debt. They've been borrowing and buying back their own shares. Part of the reason for that, at least in the case of a number of the larger companies, was that their yields were higher than the yield on their corporate debt. In other words, their cost of equity was more expensive than their cost of bonds. So they could go out and borrow more and just buy back their own shares and saving money in that regard. And then we've also had companies that have been borrowing money to buy back their own shares and to raise their dividends. Well, that has resulted in the supply of corporate bonds hitting new all-time highs. And yields have also been expanding in line with government bond yields and have probably bottomed. And there's capacity in the short term for those yields to compress somewhat. But the chances are that corporate bond yields have bottomed. And that would suggest that corporate borrowing costs have also bottomed. And it means that the gravy train that has been such a tailwind for the, I think it's called the PKW, a buyback achievers ETF, and that is comprised of US shares that have bought back 5% of their free float in the last 12 months, which is a not inconsiderable amount of percentage of their share capital. And it's outperformed the wider market by a considerable margin. Well, if we're going to see that corporate borrowing costs are rising, then the available capital and the arbitrage that has been available to get in there and start buying back shares and raising dividends is going to become more expensive. And since that has represented a substantial demand driver in the equity markets over the last 4 years, which has been fueled by this additional liquidity, it does suggest that when the buyback achievers start to deteriorate, since it is led on the upside, it's quite likely to be most sensitive to the removal of liquidity and higher borrowing costs, and is quite likely to lead on the downside. And when we think about small caps, and I did a review of small cap indices in Comment of the Day earlier on this week, the Russell 2000 has outperformed the wider market by a considerable margin, and it's one might expect that smaller cap shares might trade, and particularly high growth shares might trade on a higher PE. But when we compare the Russell 2000 to small cap indices all over the world, then we can see that they're not just a little bit more expensive than small cap everywhere else, but quite a bit more expensive, with PEs in the early 20s. And small cap indices and small cap shares respond generally favorably to a low interest rate environment. And that has certainly been the case, not just with the Russell, but with the AIM index and the Euro small caps and Japanese small caps and Australian small caps and Asian small caps. So when we start to see that borrowing costs are rising, not just on a short basis, but on a medium-term basis, then it's reasonable to anticipate that some of the smaller cap indices are also going to run into a little bit of trouble in here. So the Russell 2000 is also worthy of mention in terms of monitoring what is a mature market. We've been trending higher now for 4 years, and the threat that there is a material threat to the momentum drivers for this market. So we look at the things that have been most sensitive and performed best in the current environment, because they're going to be most sensitive and they're likely to be the things that tell us what's likely to happen next. When we think about stock markets, therefore, there are some incredibly bullish factors that are likely to persist well beyond the tapering and eventual end of quantitative easing. And veteran subscribers will be really quite familiar with them. And they are the increasing pace of technological development. And not only technological development in isolation, but the confluence of new technologies, so that people adding together new types of technologies are creating productivity gains faster than would otherwise have been the case. And we can think about this in terms of nanotechnology and 3D printing and microprocessors and small sensors and the transistors and transmitters, so that we're getting the industrialization of the internet and the homogenization of industrialization, so that our homes, our businesses, our factories, and our infrastructure is going to become increasingly more interconnected and more efficient and more intelligent. And that is going to lead to productivity gains. And productivity gains generally translate into stock market value. And when we think about the oil markets, and we've had higher oil prices over the last number of months because of anxiety about what exactly was going to happen in Syria, and that premium has since been unwound. But over the medium to long term, the potential for the supply concerns that we've grown used to over the last decade to become less of an issue because of unconventional supplies of both oil and gas and new nuclear, and the exponential innovation that is happening in the solar sector, really does raise the possibility that we're going to have an energy revolution in the next 10 to 20 to 30 years, which is going to create an abundance of energy, and which is then likely to translate into additional productivity gains and greater stock market value. And of course, we're living in the greatest age of humanism that is ever likely to occur. And the global population is likely to peak at some point in the next 20 years. And we're getting the prospect not only of having an additional 2 billion consumers over the last 10 years, but an additional 2 billion consumers in the next 10 years. And that is going to create demand for just about everything. So the consumer sector might be a little bit overbought in the short term, and valuations have expanded. And the removal of quantitative easing is likely to provide the type of ranging environment that is going to allow some valuation contraction to occur before we get back onto a growth footing for the global economy and we get back into synchronized global economic expansion. And it's been at least 5 years since we've been able to talk about that. And that's likely to give us the foundations for new secular bull markets in the vast majority of equities. But in the next 18 months, we're presented with a number of challenges. And that's likely to dominate the headlines for probably the foreseeable future. Now, when we think about the commodity markets, we've had a supply response to the supply deficit that we had 10 years ago. And that has resulted in the industrial metals mostly ranging. And the way we've defined the peak supply argument over the last decade has been in the rising cost of marginal production. And if we go back and look at the oil crisis in the 1970s, that when oil surged higher and eventually pulled back, it never got back to the levels that it had traded at before the crisis. And if we look at industrial metals, it's very similar, that we're probably in the region of the lows for the vast majority of the industrial metals, that the cost of production has risen to such an extent that it is uneconomic to produce these metals at prices that are very much below where they're trading at present. And that suggests that we're in a base formation for the majority of these industrial resources. And perhaps the most undervalued asset class in the world today are the mining companies and the types of companies that are leveraged to global economic expansion. And what we're starting to see is that the steel companies are beginning to return to a growth footing. And that's generally could be considered a positive. And if we think about gold in terms of supply and demand, then the ETF holdings of gold have perhaps been one of the most important of all charts for the precious metal markets. And they pulled back very sharply earlier on this year. And that represented the removal of what had been a remarkable demand driver for gold. Now, the ETF holdings of gold have lost downward momentum, so that the level of interest in that market has deteriorated from about 8.5 million ounces down to 6.2 million ounces. But it has at least stabilized above 6 million. And that would suggest that the holders that are still in there are likely the people that really want to hold on to the asset. And it does suggest that we are into a base formation development for gold, and that the lows that we saw in advance of the decade-long bull market in gold are probably never going to be revisited. And it would suggest that we're into the kind of ranging environment that could persist for really quite some time, but that we would need some major exogenous event to really start to push gold up to an extent that it is going to sustain moves to new high ground. The reaction that we've had to date is sufficiently large to give enough of people pause that they'll be more reticent, and that is going to require quite some time to rebuild confidence. And I think with that, I will leave you for the evening, and I wish all the best to all of you.